Oh, good evening, everyone. It's lovely to see you. My name is Gillian Wright, and I recognise lots of faces. We were just conscious that the GMC has announced this consultation and keen just to try and start some discussion about that to help people frame their responses to the consultation. The title of the consultation is, it's called Personal Beliefs and Medical Practice. So the first thing is that some people have found it difficult to find, and I've had a few emails about that already. So it's personal beliefs and medical practice. It's not conscientious objection per se. And so if you're Googling it, you need to find that bit there. And it is amending original guidance. It goes through the different aspects, and then there's some legal guidance at the end. I think that this is actually a really big topic, and I know that there will be a number of people with a variety of concerns. And we won't be able to go through the whole consultation in detail. So what we're focusing tonight is particularly on the hazards that could be there with respect to assisted suicide. I've no doubt other organisations will arrange briefings and resources which pertain to other procedures, for example, or to other aspects of the guidance. And so just in terms of focus, I think it might be helpful just to focus on things which pertain to assisted dying or assisted suicide, partly just because we're limited in terms of time as well. So without further ado, let me introduce Mary. I'm really glad that Mary Neal has come to join us. Some of you might remember Mary spoke to us before. She is an academic lawyer working in Scotland, and her particular expertise is conscientious objection or conscience rights, employment rights, particularly for doctors. I thought it would be really helpful just to ask her for her thoughts on the proposals that the GMC has made. Thanks so much for joining us, Mary, and a real welcome. There's lots of us here, so thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for inviting me, Jill. So as Jill said, I want to focus only on the conscientious objection part of the guidance, because obviously it's a longer document than that. There are other things in it, but I think conscientious objection is the bit that concerns most of you here. So I think it has to be read in that light. I should begin by saying that I am here in a personal capacity as a legal academic from the University of Strathclyde Law School. I do have a role on a GMC advisory forum that works on a project that includes the Strath guidance. So I'm not here in my capacity with the GMC. Obviously, as a member of that forum, I'm not going to say anything or betray anything that was discussed in GMC discussions, but I am here in my personal capacity anyway. As Jill said, we've all been very focused on assisted suicide and these two bills recently, so it's difficult not to read the draft guidance in light of those and looking ahead to see what might happen in future, because while it was a great relief in Scotland that the vote recently went against Liam MacArthur's bill, there's always the risk that another bill will come back at some point in the future. Much of this, as Jill said, it's an update of existing guidance. So the existing guidance, as you all know, is from 2013. And much of the draft guidance that is being consulted on now does just simply restate things from the existing guidance. But there were two kind of main headings that I just wanted to talk about. One is things that are new. So not everything is just a restatement. There are a couple of points that are specific to this new draft, and I'll highlight those. But I also think that the whole guidance needs to be read in light of the new context that I think we're in 2026. So this guidance has been in place for 13 years. We should assume that any new version that eventually is agreed upon will also be in place for a number of years. So as well as just looking at what's new in it, I think it's important to look at the whole thing with fresh eyes and think, you know, does this guidance do what it needs to do? Does it protect doctors adequately? And does it give doctors ample guidance in light of the context that they find themselves in 2026 and looking ahead potentially to another 13 years in the future? So in terms of what's new, the first thing that I picked out of the draft is paragraph 21. And on the right-hand side of the screen there, there's a quote from paragraph 21. And it says, you should be prepared to explain If you're not offering a particular procedure to a patient, you should be prepared to explain that this is due to a conscientious objection that you have. So to me, that looks new. I can't see that in the current guidance. This is about individual consultations between doctors and patients. So it's different to the previous bullet point in that paragraph, which relates to publicising the fact that you have a conscientious objection. And I'll come back to that as well. But in paragraph 21, in the second bullet point, it's telling doctors that in consultations with patients, when you're telling someone that you don't provide a procedure, you should be prepared to explain that it's due to a conscientious objection. So I have misgivings about that. I think it could potentially be a risky thing to ask a doctor to do in a one-on-one consultation with a patient. It could be in certain circumstances, it could be perceived as confronting patients with that information, with your conscientious objection. Because further on in that paragraph, it says you have to make sure that you don't make patients feel judged and you mustn't distress patients. And I think nobody would disagree with that. And obviously, doctors don't want to make patients feel distressed or judged. But the mere fact of explaining that you have a conscientious objection to something that a patient's asking for could, you know, inevitably distress somebody or make them perceive a judgment. So I'm not sure that it's necessarily a helpful thing to ask doctors to do. I think it might be better just to ask doctors simply to explain that they don't provide a particular procedure and go from there. I think adding that information that this is due to a conscientious objection, it could be quite provocative. You know, at the very least, it could make a patient feel upset. And at the most, you can imagine some situations in which it could make a patient angry. It could expose a doctor to the risk of verbal abuse or worse. So that's an addition that I am quite concerned about. And it's something that I've previously been concerned about before I saw this draft guidance. I was concerned about it in other contexts where it's been suggested that doctors should explain that they have a conscientious objection. I can see why someone might think that that's a good or a honest or transparent thing to do. But I think, you know, obviously we have the duty of candor. People might see it in those terms. It's part of the doctor's duty to always be truthful with patients. But I think that's debatable in this context. I think you're being truthful by saying that you don't provide the procedure. I'm not sure that you need to then elaborate on that. So that's the first new thing that I wanted to highlight. Another new thing, which I think is really quite concerning, perhaps more so, is in paragraph 23 of the draft, where there appears to be a new duty on doctors to provide objected treatments, so treatments that someone conscientiously objects to, a duty for doctors to do those things anyway if there isn't what's called a reasonable alternative. So the only exception to that is if the doctor has a legal right to conscientiously object. But as all of you will know, there are very, very few legal rights to conscientious objection in the UK. There's one under Section 4 of the Abortion Act. There's one under Section 38 of the Human Fertilisation and Embryology Act. But there's a whole range of other practices, of other treatments or treatments in inverted commas in some cases, things that medical professionals might object to doing that are not covered by a legal right to conscientious objection. And what this paragraph would do is it would professionally oblige a doctor to provide a treatment that they conscientiously objected to if there wasn't a legal right to conscientious objection and if no reasonable alternative could be found. So that seems to be a new duty. And it's also worth noting in that quote on the left hand of the slide there that says, as well as saying you have to provide the treatment, you must discuss all options with the patient. That's something that's also controversial. Even the fact of discussing an option, of raising an option, of mentioning a contested practice is something that many doctors think, and rightly in my opinion, think could be bordering on, if not coercion, then influence. And so something that you wouldn't feel comfortable with doing if they think that the practice itself is wrong. So it looks like one nudity, but it's actually a couple of nudities, I think, combined, a duty to discuss options and a duty to actually provide the treatment. And only a legal right to conscientiously object would shield you from that. And there aren't very many of those. Okay, so those are two new things that I think it's worth being aware of, and things that some people, when they're responding to consultations, might want to highlight or might want to mention. There's also stuff in the guidance that is not new, but I think it's worth looking at in light of how far we've come since 2013 and where we are at the moment. So one of those things is the duty to ensure that if you have a conscientious objection and if you're seeking to exercise that conscientious objection, the duty to make sure it doesn't act as a barrier to patients accessing services. So that's in this new draft guidance. It wasn't in the previous version of personal beliefs and medical practice, as far as I can see, but it is in good medical practice in paragraph 21. So it's not new because it's an existing guidance, albeit not this particular document. And it says, if you wish to exercise a conscientious objection, you must prioritise patient safety. So I don't think anybody would disagree with that. But then it goes on to say, you must make sure the way you manage this conscientious objection doesn't act as a barrier to a patient accessing appropriate care that meets their needs. So I think the question that I have around that is, you know, albeit that it is an existing guidance and that this is the guidance that everyone's been using since 2013 or since good medical practice first included it, I think my question has always been that, you know, whether this is the right place for the burden to rest. Is it really up to individual doctors to make sure, you know, to kind of navigate the tension between conscientious objection being available and patients having access to treatment? I've always felt that burden should rest somewhere else in the healthcare system, you know, with managers, with people who are directing resources to where they're needed. So I don't think it's for individual practitioners to make sure that their conscientious objections don't prevent patients from accessing care. I think that's for other people to organise the healthcare system in such a way that conscientious objection is meaningfully accommodated on the one hand, and that patients can access lawful treatments and services on the other. That's a balance that needs to be struck by someone else. It's somebody else's job to manage the provision of healthcare. So that's a concern I have about that. I've always had a concern about that. I think especially if we look ahead to something like assisted dying coming in, which at the moment when guidance talks about conscientious objection, it's thinking mainly about things like abortion people opting out of the withdrawal of life-sustaining treatment and things like that. But I think if assisted dying were to come into the picture, I think what all the polling and all the surveys of medical professionals has shown is that we would be looking at conscientious objection on a scale that we have not encountered it in relation to any other practice. So while, you know, conscientious objection to abortion is very serious for those who seek to exercise it and needs to be treated very seriously, I think it's always going to be at a level where it's not likely to pose a huge issue in terms of logistics for the health service as a whole. Whereas I think if assisted dying were to be legalised, I think the scale of conscientious objection to that would be much more likely to reach a level where this kind of tension might arise, you know, where there might be a realistic, and I would say more than a realistic chance, I would say a probability actually, that there would be sufficient levels of conscientious objection in the profession to make it a bit of a headache for those organising services. So I think if we're looking at, you know, if we're horizon scanning and imagining a future which I don't want, and I'm sure many of you don't want, in which assisted dying were to become legal, I think in that kind of future, do we want the guidance that doctors are having to rely on to have this kind of duty in it? And for doctors to be the ones who bear the burden of making sure that their conscientious objections don't impede patients from accessing what might by that time be being discussed as appropriate care, you know, however much that might be a problematic way to refer to something like assisted dying. So I think that's something, these more familiar duties that have been in the guidance for many years, I think they start to take on a different complexion when you look ahead to assisted dying. So I would say this is a duty that I would regard as being problematic anyway. I think it's liable to become more problematic in the future. And likewise with the duty to signpost patients on to non-objecting professionals. So it's in paragraph 21. It's familiar. It's something that is in the existing guidance. So it says you must make sure that the patient has enough information to arrange to see another professional who doesn't have the same objection as you, so that they can discuss all the options available to them. It isn't new, but again, doing this horizon scanning exercise, a lot of doctors who are maybe comfortable with signposting in relation to the treatments that are currently subject to a right to conscientiously object, they might feel different about assisted dying. It's something that seems to kind of reach out to people who don't conscientiously object to any treatment that's currently legal. But this seems to be a red line for a lot of professionals. I think it's at least possible that a lot of them wouldn't even want to signpost patients to assisted dying. So that's something else that I think has to be taken into consideration in relation to this guidance, albeit that the duty to signpost is something that is quite familiar, that appears in existing guidance. I think, again, we have to think of ourselves as being in a kind of different landscape now and consider all of these duties in terms of, you know, would we want to have this duty in a jurisdiction that allowed assisted dying? That was the final slide, but I think I would want to say as a kind of final thought, I think it's important to just remember that we don't know what rights would be available to healthcare professionals under any assisted dying law that was passed. In Scotland, the conscience provision had to be stripped out as a Scottish bill because it was not competent, and that actually was a big factor in the bill failing. It was a bill that about assisted dying that imposed, you know, a whole process on medical professionals and didn't allow them any right to opt out. There were all sorts of promises about provision being made by Westminster for Scottish doctors, but there was no conscience protection on the face of the bill that MSPs were being asked to pass into law. And Royal Colleges came out against the bill because of that. And I think that gave a lot of MSPs pause for thought. So it's important to remember that, you know, as things stand, no Scottish bill has contained a feasible conscience clause. So the most recent bill was the only one that included any kind of conscience clause, and it turned out to be ineffective and incompetent. The bills before that in Scotland didn't even include a conscience clause because they knew that they didn't have the right to do that. So it's likely that when this guidance is being finalised, we'll have no idea that, you know, what kind of conscience rights doctors might have in relation to assisted dying if that is ever legalised. So and kind of refer back to the discussion that I had about on this slide here about doctors being forced to provide treatments unless they have a legal right to conscientious objection in circumstances where there isn't an alternative. Who knows what the legal right to conscientious objection might be, or even if there would be one at all in relation to something like assisted dying. So it's just really important, I think, to bear in mind that we live in a different landscape than we did in 2013. Assisted dying has always been somewhere on the kind of cloud on the horizon in the distance. I think it's now a kind of cloud that's closer to us. So that makes it a different landscape, but it's also a very uncertain landscape because we don't know if assisted dying were to come in, what form that would take, and specifically what form any conscience provision would take. So I think when thinking about this draft guidance and how to respond to it and what points you might want to pick up in the draft guidance, I think, yes, look at the new things, the new duties that it seems to impose, but don't just look at the new things because everything's new in a sense. So Jill, I'm just going to leave it there, if that's okay.
That's brilliant. Thank you. Thanks so much. I was just going to draw your attention to point 11. I don't know if people have it in front of them. It says you may be required to fulfill contractual requirements that could limit your freedom to work in line with your beliefs. Full stop. And it says this may include conscientious objections, working patterns, as well as organizational policies and dress codes. So my reading of that sentence is that you, because of contractual requirements, you may have to waive your conscientious objection. I don't know if other people read that way. These are matters between medical professionals and their employing or contracting bodies. So I'm presuming they're referring to things like working on a Sunday and you might be required to work on a Sunday or, you know, another day that was important to your faith, as well as dress codes, which might be important to some in their faith. But I think the fact that it says this may include conscientious objections, I think I find that quite concerning. Because to fulfill your contractual obligation, you would therefore not have a conscientious objection permitted. And so I suppose I think that whole sentence is of concern. So I think these are the things that are worth a number of us responding to. Mary, did you want to come back in?
Yes, just to say a couple of things. First of all, I do read that paragraph 11 the same way that you do, Jill, that I think the argument would be if somebody signed a contract of employment, and they've signed up to it, then they will be expected to waive any conscientious objection, and that they, unless it's a legal right. But also, if you look at paragraph 20, it says in there, and again, I think this is something that's not in the previous version of the guidance. It says, about halfway down paragraph 20, it says you should be open with potential employers before you accept a job, if you know that part of the role could involve something that you conscientiously object to. So that involves expecting applicants for jobs to scan the entirety of a role or a professional job and think about things that they might potentially object to and then flag those up to potential employers before they accept a job. So they're trying to make sure that nobody comes into a job wanting to conscientiously object to something. So that would basically mean anybody who was applying for any job that involved, and if we're thinking about assisted suicide or euthanasia or something like that, we know that if that were to come in, it could potentially impact on many, many areas of the health service. So anybody coming into any of those jobs would be having to say to a potential employer before they accepted the job, hang on, you know, I conscientiously object to assisted suicide or euthanasia and I don't want to be involved in that.
Yeah, very important. And I mean, I remember speaking to a hospice director about her role, and she said she would not have participated in assisted suicide, but she was also concerned for her managerial or administrative role, and in that she would be responsible for the rota, for, you know, for on-call requirements, for cover if somebody was ill. And so therefore, did that mean that she could not hold the post of a hospice director? And I think that's also just relevant in terms of one of the legal cases in the appendices is Dugan. So that was one of the abortion or the key abortion conscientious objection case. And the key is whether you have direct or indirect involvement. And again, this is one of the problems with, you know, not knowing the conscience clause for the Scottish Bill. You don't know how specific it will be. So it's just these sorts of concerns are significant, and I think just worth bearing in mind.
I think there would be so many roles and tasks that would be impacted in relation to assisted suicide that it would be thousands of people having to say that they objected if they did object. And very few of them would be covered, I think, by the conscience provision in the statute, as we're kind of anticipating that would be.
So just to explain that, so Mary, in terms of if there was an assisted dying or assisted suicide law, that would be statute law, and that you would expect that provision to supersede what's in the GMC guidance? Or how does it work? How do the two interplay?
Well, the GMC guidance isn't law. So statutory law is the highest source of positive law in the UK. So if there's a statutory conscience clause like there is in the Abortion Act, if there were to be a statutory conscience clause in any assisted suicide bill or act, then that would provide the baseline, I suppose, for people who conscientiously objected to it. But as we've seen, those clauses in the current bills, or in the Westminster bill and the recent Scottish bill, they imposed duties as well as allowing for opt-outs. So they were allowing people to opt out of direct participation. That was the wording of the Scottish clause before it was stripped out as a bill. So that it was clearly following the Dugan formula, even though it's a, you know, they don't have to follow Dugan. Dugan was about Section 4 of the 1967 Act, but it has kind of created people who are not particularly favourable towards conscientious objection like the formula that was set out in Dugan and are keen to apply it in other contexts like assisted suicide. So in other words, to disallow conscientious objection except in narrow circumstances and for very direct kinds of involvement, hands-on involvement. So that's the pattern that is being followed, I think, in both bills, that both bills only envisage allowing people to opt out of direct involvement. So all the forms of indirect involvement that would be all around assisted suicide as a practice would not be covered by a conscience clause. So there'd be no statutory right to opt out of all the direct, indirect forms of involvement that people might be expected to have. And so yeah, that would be quite a narrow provision.
Exactly, yeah.
I've got a kind of overarching concern. So in point three, they've limited from their previous guidance. So previous guidance acknowledged that all medical professions and patient personal beliefs that influence their life, which I think is just manifestly true. Of course, we all live from a, you know, philosophical foundation. But this guidance has limited it to many medical professions and patients, as if they're limiting kind of beliefs only to perhaps minority religious groups, you know. And they've said many, so they're trying not to say, you know, a few. But I think that limiting is quite significant because it kind of tries to play those who have a conscientious objection as kind of a exclusion, whereas actually, no, everybody lives from a metaphysical set of beliefs and should be allowed and encouraged to do so. And in fact, you can't practice medicine without that. So I think there's some kind of overarching tone concerns.
So there is a specific question on that, which for those who've responded already, I think from memory, I'll just think where I wrote it down. Question 19. That there is something about there being a range of belief systems and it being kind of almost considered as a challenge to be overcome, that somebody might have a conscientious objection, whereas they were trying to frame it more neutrally.
They've actually made it less neutral. So although in the question they say they're trying to frame it more neutrally than the 2013 guidance, what they've actually done is make it less neutral. And they've never highlighted point three in any of the sections of the consultation. So they highlight various sections to ask questions about, but they never ask a question about those earlier paragraphs explicitly or highlight that they've made that change.
So these are really, really helpful points, and I suppose that, like, that question 19 would be somewhere to bring in that point about question three, but I think it's really helpful to hear you make that connection because I'd not made that before. I'm conscious of everybody's time, we're coming to close. Gordon, do you want to come back in just before we head?
Yeah, I think that again within the context of assisted suicide euthanasia, there is a potential issue here, which is that in neither of the bills was there any institutional opt-out being proposed. In fact, there would be a duty on institutions to provide the service. So whilst there was talk about individual doctors being able to have a conscientious objection opt-out and also talk about no detriment clauses, the institution, the management, would have to provide the service if it was requested by one of the patients. So you could imagine that over a period of time, for example, in the hospice sector, the management might begin to say, well, we've got to provide this service. We're struggling to provide it because the palliative care doctors don't want to do it. So we will make it a requirement of working in our hospice that you have to be willing to do this. And so as new people are coming through training programs, they might find that their rights to object and not participate if they want to have a career in palliative care, or, for example, in general practice, might be restricted. So I think that's what you need to bear in mind.
Yeah, thanks, Gordon. That's helpful. Yeah, so very clear, institutional opt-out was completely disregarded by the Scottish Committee. And then, you know, it was just not an option. And there was much winsome argument put for it and completely disregarded. And that's something we can think about in terms of, you know, how we approach that in the future. But it was remarkable in the discussions in the Scottish Parliament. One MSP suggested that a homeless shelter should not be required to provide it because of their principles, their founding principles. And he gave the example of the Salvation Army. And the Scottish Health Committee said that it was reasonable to expect assisted dying or assisted suicide in that context, because that was their home. So it was a difficult committee, but that's the way these things get passed, because nobody said no. So the unimaginable was talked about and passed. The Lords also refused to allow exceptions for those as well. So just to say thank you so much for being here tonight. I think at the moment I would not rely on just the organisations. Organisations will definitely put in something, we will, but please, if individuals can, and even if it's just putting in, you know, some comments about the, you know, the big picture stuff, that's really helpful. With all these things, they look at the numbers. So, you know, if there's lots of people responded on one particular question, you know, they will respond to that. So it is helpful to have individuals respond as well, and we'll look to see what we can do together. And thank you. Yeah, thanks so much for being with us. And talk to your colleagues. You know, just we need a body of people, you know, just raising, to ask them questions. You need, it doesn't have to be confrontational. You know, how do you feel? Do you think that's a helpful way of phrasing that? You know, does that apply to what we do? Do you think that would make it difficult for us in this situation? What about that? You know, just genuinely just ask them questions and see how they respond and you see where it takes you. I appreciate it has been a discussion. A really big thank you to Mary. We really appreciate your expertise, but also your work in this area for many years and the expertise that you have shared and gleaned, and the fact that you have contributed in a number of significant bodies over the years and safeguarded conscientious objection in many different domains. So thank you for that. It's lovely to see so many of you, actually. Thank you so much. And yeah, take care. And we'll be in touch soon. Okay, good night. Thank you.